This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know how I've been talking lately about how we're all so good at offering favors to people, but so reluctant to ask someone for help ourselves? It turns out the same thing is true for mental health. We talk about mental health more openly than we ever have. The conversation is everywhere. And yet, when it's our turn, when we're the one who actually needs to ask for help, somehow it still feels too hard. That gap is real, and BetterHelp went and measured it. BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of Americans believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from doing so. Sit with that for a second. Nearly everyone agrees that reaching out is the smart, healthy thing to do. And yet most of us still feel the culture pushing against that wisdom. We've won the argument in the abstract and lost it in the moment. So here's the question I'd put to you, the Team Human listener. When's the last time you encouraged a friend to consider talking to someone? And when's the last time you gave yourself that same permission? Closing that gap doesn't start with a policy. It starts with us, treating it as normal, out loud. If you've been thinking of talking to someone, BetterHelp makes it easier to start. It's online, it's flexible, and it fits the life you actually have. 30,000 fully licensed therapists, a commitment to match you with the right one, and more than 12 years perfecting the online therapy experience. Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Before we start, I just want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Everyone's Earth, the company behind Kobe Dryer Sheets, and host of soon-to-be-released biodegradable products to replace the plastic-infused crap that leaches from our landfills and sewers into the ecosystem forever. Yes, they make this show possible, but they're also giving this show purpose. If all we end up doing here is keeping microplastics out of a few placentas by converting people to compostable products, Team Human will have been more than worth it. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to transcend the pretense of linear order and embrace the chaotic swirl in which wonderfully weird phenomena emerge. Fear not, we are dreaming this dream together, and we don't have to accept the nightmare at face value. There are cracks in the illusion and plenty of people willing to play in the liminal zones they open. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, the author of Technosis, High Weirdness, and the just-released History of the LSD Medium, Blotter, esoteric scholar Eric Davis. Eric will be helping us retrieve the power of the counterculture to confront and metabolize the unweird. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. Eric, it's great to see you.
Always good to see you, Doug. It's been a while. We've been hanging out for quite some years.
Quite some years. Lately, it's been more Zoom like this than real life. But it's been important to me to have these occasional kind of check-ins.
Absolutely. Totally.
I guess this is a version of that. So our audience in some ways will be a flies on the wall of me getting to engage with you just for fun. For fun and comfort and healing.
Yeah.
Gosh, I was just reading your latest Substack, which came out like today on what's your Substack called? I just go to it.
Burning Shore.
Right, Burning Shore. And you, like me, are kind of looking at different kinds of weirdness. You know, there was the fun, original weirdness of, like, that we just, Art Bell radio show, UFOs, UAPs, ESP, counterculture, psychedelic states, are there machine elves? Is there a chaotic tractor at the end of time? What are crop circles? Sort of, you know, the X-Files meets spirituality thing. And as you were writing, though, the weirdness has taken on a new, there's a new kind of novelty in town.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at some levels, at least for me, it was always partly there. Like, it was part of what attracted me to weird stuff was the way that it was kind of not, that it was sort of suspect, or that it might be, you know, it's like a window into another world, but it's fringed with mischief and threat. You know, like, I think of fairies. Like, if you look at fairy lore, like, on the one hand, you're like, oh my God, there are these marvelous non-human creatures that inhabit our fields and forests, and we can interact with them, and they and there's these kind of uncanny encounters. But there's also, like, a sort of scary side to fairies. You know, they can abduct babies and swap them out for, like, fakes, you know, for, like, original simulacra. And they're, you know, associated in some zones with hell. And, you know, so there's, like, kind of a lot of ambivalence for me around the weird, which is part of what made it attractive. Like, wasn't right quite sure what it was or what side it was on. And it feels to me like that aspect of the weird has become more and more pronounced as we just, you know, whatever, you know, hurtle on forward into all of these, you know, novelties.
It's interesting. You also, another vector where I feel like you've been maybe more balanced than me is the credulity, sort of the credulity vector. You know, like I feel like there's sort of, certainly in the mid-90s, there was kind of me on the one end about, you know, oh my God, we're going to realize the you know, collective human organism through psychedelics and technology. On the other end of the spectrum was, like, you know, Mark Derry or Richard Barbaruch saying, these men are insane. They're libertarians. They're going to drive us off a cliff. And then you were kind of in the middle saying, well, there's some interesting things here. They're interesting whether they're true or not. You know, you've sort of maintained a balanced approach throughout.
Yeah, no, that's always been very important to me. I don't know if it's just my personal temperament or, you know, it's like my, you know, Buddhist love of equanimity, or it's a certain kind of, I don't know, a kind of playful skepticism that I've always enjoyed. And I think in many ways it's done me well, because I was able to see challenges in the picture but not become hysterical or completely negative about them. I think, for example, you know, Technosis came out in 1998. So imagine, if you will, like a book about spirituality and technology written in at the end of the 90s as we're hurtling up the first, you know, boom, right, and, you know, or the first scam, whatever you want to see it. And, you know, and I, because I'm positive about magic and mysticism and spirituality, like, you could imagine a version of that book that was really just hype, you know, or just enthusiasm and mania. But I was always a little bit on this kind of skeptical side as well, and so I was able to see ahead and to say things like, well, isn't it odd that just as on the one hand people are talking about Teilhard de Chardin and the noosphere, and we're creating the global mind, and these sort of ancient Neoplatonic metaphors are returning as this idea of a grid of information and a unified planet and planetary consciousness on the one side, we can go right over here and we can see Christian paranoias about the Antichrist system and the one world government and, you know, control and manipulation, and to recognize that even one of the great figures that illuminated my work and definitely was very influential to yours as well, Marshall McLuhan, in his own mind saw both potentials. And in his public statements might be a little more positive, like, here we go, we're creating this whole global electronic mind. And then in his letters, he's like terrified about Satan taking over the planet. You know, like he also even kind of wrestled with these two kind of visions. And to me, it's part of what the apocalyptic imagination, in a way, is about, is kind of revelation of newness and novelty and potential and new ways of organizing things. But it's often coupled with this, or generally coupled with this kind of fear and transformation and violence and control. And I've always kind of seen technology sort of under both of those lenses and everywhere in between. And it's just kind of given me a way of navigating through things that has its own, you know, downsides, but I think also enabled that book at least to still be relevant, so that young right. people now are reading this thing that was written before social media and before the iPhone, and it's like ancient, and yet it still resonates because I was able to tap into some of these forms and forces in a way that was respectful to both the light and the dark.
Well, right, and you get into, I mean, we both do, into larger patterns. So, you know, you could watch, David Lynch Twin Peaks Returns episode 8 or 13, whatever it was, of the, you know, atomic bomb going off and being the rift from one reality into another. And that's when Bob was born. And, you know, it was like, oh, wow. So you can go back and say, I mean, you write about that too, that maybe it was that moment in the 40s and 50s that maybe that was, I mean, everyone picks a different rift. Oh, the right. kids say 9/11 was it. Or my parents would say Kennedy assassination. It changed everything. Yeah. And my grandparents were like World War One. After World War One, we saw the industrial killing. It was, you know, everything was forever changed. So maybe every generation gets one or two rifts that destabilize things like that.
Yeah, and I think for us also, the 90s was an interesting kind of rift, different kind of rift. And I still feel, and it's nice to talk to you about this, I still feel that we, and even I, haven't really figured out how to assimilate, integrate, digest, narrate what the 90s was about. And I haven't read all the literature of books that people have done, and it's not that extensive. But you know, I've dipped into discourses about the 90s and about Gen X, and it's kind of our decade, and da da da. And I'm still, even when I reflect on my own experience and my own enthusiasm and my own exposure to a lot of these weird currents, and it was kind of like in my mind, sort of the last great flowering of sort of not online subcultures. And you know, it was such an interesting time, but it's also hard to recover because I think a lot of it looks really like kind of suspect and naive, which maybe it was, but we can see it in our own careers, but it's not enough to just go, oh, we were fools. Oh, Richard Barbrook was right after all.
No, I wouldn't do that. No, I mean, I pretty clearly identify the 90s as this decade where we increased our sort of dimensional appreciation of reality, that we went from perspective painting to holography, from Euclidean math to chaos math, you know, from these you know, basically 3D to 4D in some ways in our understanding of how the world worked. This in some ways sort of quantum consciousness, but we hadn't realized it. It was completely an idea. And the reason why I think the 90s is becoming totally clear now is AI is that multidimensional consciousness thing. AI actually can behold our world from more than one perspective at a time. It can kind of realize the thing. And now that we're in it, it's way less fun than the one we were imagining. You know, we weren't imagining the realization of a cult-driven leadership as Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
But the 90s was about envisioning it. And that's why I think it's fine that a lot of us were optimistic, because we had optimistic pictures of it, and then we tempered it with some good Marx and you know, other important philosophers to ground it in reality. And it's not – I don't think we've lost I don't think we lost our ability to realize a lot of that vision either. If anything, it feels more important now than ever.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that I think one of the gifts, one of the errors to make is to just see the mistakes or the excessive hope or the lack of fear or concern about the ways that this could go south, and we only see that and we don't see the sense of real possibility. Because in a way, I think that's one of the challenges we're in right now, is to like be able to truly inhabit an imagination of the possible that is collective, that might be wild. Doesn't have to be super grounded, because I'm looking around, I don't see a lot of super grounded stuff at this point. Feels like we're hurtling into the groundless ground on some level. But I think a lot of people are so chained by the threats and the narratives and the visible conflicts and the shutting down of real possibilities in many dimensions, and we lose that sense of possibility that I think is at the heart of that 90s moment, but also part of what counterculture I think is really about, in that there is sort of a gesture towards what is possible, but also what is not yet known, and that it's like an open not knowing about what lies around the corner and the possibility that it might actually be kind of cool. That gets harder and harder to carve out a space for, I think, in our contemporary moment. And so, looking back at the 90s, I would prefer to be inspired by the ways in which it was imagining worlds that didn't come to be, but not because they were impossible, but because fate and power and money and karma and capital and all these other things, attracted them into another direction. And that the that's I still prefer that idea of capture rather than inevitability. And some of those people, like Barbrook at the time, who was going, this is just libertarian stuff. The California is just like libertarians meet the hippies, and they're just going to take it out of any social context, and they're going to do the kind of stuff that we see now. In a way, I was like, yeah, you were right, but not because you saw the truth. It's like you recognized a potential that ended up being more the world that we inhabited in
Right.
ways that did surprise us.
And there's also, there's a tendency a lot now to do these kind of, I don't know, revisionist histories of counterculture figures. Whether it's, oh, Timothy Leary was a sellout, or oh, Stuart Brand was actually a soldier and a capitalist and inherited a bunch of money. And it's like, on a certain level, I feel, who cares? Who cares? It's like, what? Anybody's got a shitty history on some level or other. Anybody's entitled. Anybody's a this or a that. And it's like the only way you can judge, if you want to, any of these people is how were they in the moment? What was he like on the bus with Ken Kesey and the other pranksters? Was he bossing them around like a military general, or was he there and present and loving them and bringing whatever he learned in the army to the logistics of, we've got to drive to this town by this date or it's going to rain on us? Maybe it was just that.
Getting shit done. I think Brand is especially good on that pragmatic know-how tip. But that is an unfortunate side of cultural memory right now, and it's very popular, as you say, around countercultural figures. And part of it is just, in a way, an understandable reaction to kind of celebrity culture and to the fact that we had already for decades been narrating this the story of the 60s through these great men.
Right.
And so it was about Leary, and then we know the story of Leary, and people talk about Leary, we talk about these characters, and forgetting all of the social context and all the currents through no names and collectives and places and imaginaries. And that's
Right.
always harder for us to get a hold of. And so then at some point, when you look back at the 60s, the most dominant figures are these celebrities, are these
Right. And
characters.
you
And then
kind of
you're
have
like,
to,
oh,
right.
whoa, I can turn it around upside down, and
Right.
oh, that doesn't look so good. So the whole thing was bunk. And it's like,
Right.
no.
You got to separate the figures from the ground at that point and go, okay, there were these
Exactly.
dudes there, but look at what manifested. And there's problems with all of it. Millbrook wouldn't have happened with a bunch of money and a private estate and all that. I mean, anything, there's always those sides to it. But where I thought you were going before, which is really interesting, and I think you kind of mentioned it in your last piece or two on Substack, is the way that current circumstances, particularly the kind of fear and vertigo that can be induced by something as simple as the Pope's Donald Trump making himself look like the Pope. Things like that, they're shocking. I mean, and destabilizing, and in some ways they prevent us from reaching the from being calm and collected and breathing enough to do the kinds of thinking and feeling we need to navigate effectively.
Yeah, it's a real, I think we're in a really, really tricky spot with things like that. And I think it's worth staying with that image a little bit, because it was something that affected me really tremendously. I read about it and I consciously did not want to go out and look at it. And then my mom sent it to me, and she sent it to me not because she's a Trumpy and not because she's like a hysterical anti-Trumpy. She just sort of knew it was the kind of image that I would be interested in, just because of the combination of like religion and the absurdity of it and the weirdness of it and all that. And it really struck me. And then the more I thought about it, I thought about something. Let me run this by you as a kind of interesting symptom of where we are. Okay. Somebody, some random person, uses AI to come up with this image, right? It's a cheesy image. It's easy. It's dumb. It's banal. It's the kind of thing people do with AI image generators on its own, finding it somewhere in the stew of our everyday feeds, just on X or whatever. You'd be like, whatever. Okay, kind of dumb, you know? But when the man himself retweets it, it completely changes.
Right.
It becomes an entirely different thing. So it's really good example of how, like, if you want to call it information warfare, works, because we get caught up in thinking that it's about the content, because that's how our minds operate. But it's so much in this case about the deployment. We see it as something that moves from one register to another and achieves distribution by this incredibly powerful position in the information landscape, which completely transforms it, because it's self-referential, because it's beyond irony. Is this ironic? Is it not ironic? Does he actually want to be Pope? We can't even process it anymore. And it's that effect of the transmission of this image, not its content, that creates this kind of nausea, and this kind of like the sense of profaning even the last vestiges of some kind of classy way of thinking about religion or respecting the death of figures. And then it strikes us in this weird combination where it's on the one hand, it's shocking, and on the other hand, right next door, it's just stupid. It's just banal. So if it was purely shocking, it would be galvanizing. But instead, it's like, oh my God, not again. Oh yeah, it's just this stupid fucking dumb AI piece. I'm sorry if I swear, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that combo, I think, is particularly dangerous because of the way that it undermines our reactions,
right,
and makes it hard to navigate.
It's hard to know how to feel and what to do. You know, it's like, because it's so puerile,
yeah,
and powerful at the same time. And it's like, but I mean, ultimately, it doesn't just undermine the sanctity or authority of the Pope. It also undermines the sanctity and authority of the presidency, right? It's in some ways, as a move toward, on the dark side, toward pure power. It's like, yeah, I'm even more powerful than the president. It's just me, which is...
Yeah, it's almost like you see him behind his awareness of the mask or the power or the role or function of the president. And again, you know, we have to acknowledge something about, especially coming from countercultural background, is that if we want to go and tell a story about where that kind of attitude comes from, a lot of it we're going to find in the kind of satirical counterculture.
Yeah. I spent a bunch of years upset about that. You know, it's like Abby Hoffman and the pranksters and, you know, levitating the Pentagon and Paul Krasner writing The Realist and saying that Lyndon Johnson, you know, penetrated the exit wound in the back of JFK's skull on Air Force One, that Jackie O walked in on it. He wrote this story that was taken. It was the original fake news. But it's one thing. I mean, I get it's one thing when the counterculture is doing it to destabilize right. an entrenched, dominating cultural picture. It's another when what is happening now, when the leadership is doing it, or is Donald Trump and his team's perception that they are a countercultural minority trying to take down, you know, the master's house with, you know, the interactive tools.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it is important to make those distinctions and to not be facile about what connects them. And it's just, you know, we have to kind of reframe what we mean by chaos and what we mean by the breakdown of these kinds of, you know, rules of thumb, of structures of consensus reality, of, you know, sort of ways to do things. And I'm really afraid about what happens because of the way that it empowers actors on all levels of society to kind of abandon norms and mores. And it's sort of weird because then it sounds like, oh, I sound like a conservative.
I know.
It's like, I want to maintain maintain these basic
Normans,
you know? And then it's important to remember that, of course, these guys aren't really Republicans. They're not, I mean, they're not really conservatives. In fact, they're not conservatives. What I think of, what I kind of just going over to talk about a countercultural source that was really important for both of us was, you know, Robert Anton Wilson. And in the Illuminatus trilogy, I'm reminded that, you know, the Illuminati in that book, even though they are this dark manipulative force that is actually behind all of the assassinations of positive figures in the 60s, like, you know, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and, you know, that they're actually the kind of this evil force. They're not actually conservatives in the novel. They're basically transhumanists. They want to, like, deconstruct everything and build this new and immanentize the eschaton. And it's sort of shocking, like, reading through that again, I'm like, oh, and that's why this connection between this recently forged but so powerful kind of connection between the Silicon Valley, the Silicon Valley's rightward turn, and the Trump chaos, puerile performance, and the creepy new Christian nationalism, or relatively new Christian nationalism, is so, like, terrifying, because it's kind of like both and. It's like you get
right.
the old school social conservative, we're gonna, like, you know, kill the queers and force women to have babies and you know, beat up on you know, immigrants, even though that's not what the Bible says. And at the same time, you have this, like transhumanist mutation of all these sort of given structures of society, economic, political, cultural, all these sort of elements are kind of like willfully mutated in light of this hope or perception of these kind of singularitarian changes.
But it does, it also, though, it helps clarify and define what they see as, like, Satanism, because of all of us who are left out of that. So, and I'm always very willing, no matter how tripping or how into whatever I'm doing I am, to accept the possibility that what I'm doing is wrong, is the evil thing, right? Mm. So here I am, you know, doing mushrooms and realizing that we've got to stop building things because the planet only has so much resources. We've got to reconnect with nature and all. And I understand that Hobbes would say, oh, so you're not a Christian. You're just an animal. You want to go be a native. Or that it's some kind of Rousseau, the primitive hero worship. Or that I'm anti-capitalist and slowing down the human project. That as the Bible, at least through King James, would say, no, man does want to be abstracted and rise above matter and don't. That me, when I'm thinking I'm at my spiritual best on mushrooms at an ecstatic dance, having the same kind of connection with every person in there, male, female, young, old, beyond sex connected, take me now, I'm okay to even die because I know that this moment is forever, that could, you know what I mean? That is,
yeah,
in some ways, is the definition of evil and Satanism to this other side.
Yeah. No. I'm with you on that. I think we share that. And I think, at the beginning we were talking about sort of my mixed approach to a lot of things. And it's partly because I have that capacity I'm unwilling to crystallize certainty out of even some of my most sublime experiences. And that's been like a choice or my nature, my personality. And it has this effect about beliefs as well, that I've had these incredible ecstatic experiences. And some of them have been contradictory. I've had Christian ones as well. And yet I just go, why am I supposed to crystallize this into some kind of certainty? But that uncertainty bug and that not knowing quality, which is also part of my spiritual life through my practice of Zen and things like that, like it's something I've been kind of cultivating, but it's difficult to orient, especially when we're in an environment that's so driven and dominated by certainty and the power that comes with certainty and the way in which certainty, particularly in a situation where people are confused and they feel lost and they don't know and they know that they don't know and they're not enjoying it. If there's somebody who's got certainty around them, it's very attractive.
Right.
And that, welcome to Instagram.
Yeah, or any ism. I mean, once Jewishness and Torah becomes Judaism, I'm like, oh, no, they locked it down. Once the social imperative of Marx to share with each other becomes socialism, it's like, oh, no, now you're going to get a Politburo institutionalizing this fucking thing. And how do you stay, I mean, this is what we're both trying to do, how do you stay in that liminal space of uncertainty and realizing that in there, it's not even atheism. In that total uncertainty, your ethics ends up having to emerge spontaneously in some ways as a not even a state of being, but a way of acting.
Yeah, it's like a situational response, and it was something that I realized. I remember when I was doing a lot of study of Taoism and Buddhism, and also aware of the criticisms and how I've always been interested in how conservative Christians read these kinds of things when they actually know something about them. And so I'm aware of some of these issues that you're talking about. And one of the kind of insights I had is like, well, really, at some point, there's this profound, call it faith, that if you deconstruct all the BS, you will respond appropriately spontaneously. That there's a faith in the spontaneous emergence of a proper ethical response to any given situation. And once I kind of identified it as a faith, go with the flow, let the Tao do da 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 da. Once I saw that it was a faith, I could pull it up and go, well, that's got some of the problems that these other faiths have. And in fact, I can see, certainly looking at the history, that there's a lot of people who believe that, and they weren't doing stuff that was very good. And so I'm like, ooh, okay, well,
feels good is good really doesn't make sense. When a feels good is good philosophy is, again, it's a nonspecific amplifier of anything the fuck you want it to be, right?
Yeah.
Feels good is good. It feels good to go kill those Native Americans over there. That was a good, as long as you build the right parties around it, you contextualize it as a natural expression of whatever.
Yeah. And it doesn't feel to me like this kind of thing we're talking about is necessarily even helpful in certain kinds of historical circumstances. I think in some historical circumstances, this is a great way to live, a great way to orient yourself. But in a time where we are now, I sometimes really question my own tendency to go towards this place because I see how much cash is minted from the people who have certainty. And it looks like I'm going to fight that with uncertainty. Like I'm going to like erode the growing ideological power of reactionary orthodoxy over young men in America by going, hey, uncertainty's kind of cool and it sort of vibes with the Tao and it like lets you see the multiplicity.
And
I'm like,
it's not
going to work.
No, it's not for everybody. Just like, you know, it's like the rabbi is supposed to, when you want to go to convert to Judaism, the rabbi is supposed to turn you away like three times. Even if you go to the people who go to the Dalai Lama who are Christians and say, oh, I want to be Buddhist. He's always like, no, more than enough Buddhists already.
It's
like,
I love it.
Yeah, because it's like, if you knew what being a Buddhist was going to be like, you wouldn't have signed up. It's a tough road. But then, you know, so we're trying, which is very sweet of us, you know, we're trying to be open and accepting and MAGA whisperers, I suppose, in our own way, to say that they've got a perspective, which they do, and we're pointing out this seeming rift, you know, which to me is an opportunity. You know, the rift between the sort of the MAGA Christians and the transhumanist Muskians. You know, they aren't really on the same page. Steve Bannon is really trying to point that out. But do you see, I mean, because I kind of do, a similar split on the left? I feel like there is between the kind of on the ground activist kind of data-rich leftists, the real on-the-ground Marxists, and the kind of the psychedelic, playful tricksters, the people who, oh, we're going to legalize ecstasy and mushrooms by getting medical protocols for it, and the other ones who are like, let's just do this in church, you know, that there does seem to be a similar rift on the other side.
Interesting. Tell me a little bit more about that, maybe particularly in the psychedelic world, because that's something really concrete and a particularly interesting one too, because it's really one of the only bipartisan sort of projects that's alive right now in America. So I'd love to hear a little more what you mean by that distinction.
Well, I mean, there's in some ways, you know, for better and for worse, the group Symposia exposed a lot of them, but that in the effort to legalize ecstasy, MDMA, as a therapeutic drug, the MAPS people also developed a protocol around it that was embedded with certain values about how the world works, about trauma and how to metabolize trauma and sort of it was... I think mostly right. It was basically my therapeutic process, but something I could certainly understand a Christian looking at as Satanism itself. What, you're just going to metabolize, work your way through this thing and you know, find out who you really are, or whatever those things are. So there was that side. And then there's I feel like there's another strong and perhaps more sensible movement to bring psychedelics into the spiritual communities and let different communities sort of amplify different sets of values.
Yeah, I mean, I find the situation of psychedelics to be endlessly interesting. I've had to work to kind of separate the parts that I still think are worth really tracking from there's just so much noise and so much hype and so much like enmity and attack, you know, right. A lot of the stuff that happened around Symposia is really complicated and not, a lot of people didn't behave well on both sides, and it's sort of like got, you know, because it's more powerful, there's more, you know, kind of people involved. But the reason I still think it's very worth paying attention to how it rolls out, is I don't think any of the models that we have are really going to work. And what that means is that the models in not working are always going to show you something both about the way our society is organized today and about what is sort of unique about psychedelics. And to tie this a little bit to what we were talking about before, it's kind of like there's a reason that esoteric things were esoteric throughout the history of culture and religion. And that is that they're not really for everybody, at least at the stage that most people are trying to just make a living, get ahead, keep their families together, what they need, how do they want to orient their heart, how do they want to know themselves and feel good about their part of the world and the people who are around them, et cetera, because a lot of these esoteric practices and experiences have a kind of deconstructing quality. They pull the rug out from under you, or they show a multiplicity world. Sometimes it's that God is everywhere, which is pretty groovy, but then you're still like, well, where do I put that? You know, they're in some ways unsettling. And now what we're doing is we're kind of democratizing esoteric and mystical experience through psychedelics, increasingly through technological means, through the rapid spread of breath practices, and all this sort of new age zone is filled with all of these kinds of ways of generating these kind of outlandish experiences that then don't really always have a place to live, and in fact can become very destructive, particularly because they're not within the kind of frameworks that they might have had more traditionally, where even the esoteric mystic is still inside the framework of traditional Islam, for example, but they're having their Sufi mystical experience and it's kind of crazy, and the conservatives are like, those guys are crazy, but it's still sort of within a worldview, within a framework, within an orienting point that in now just becomes consumer capitalism. So just to come around, I think you are correct in your intuition that one of the best things and one of the more interesting things that can happen is how religion gets vitalized by these substances. It's dangerous. There's going to be cults. There's going to be delusions. There's going to be spiritual inflation. All of those things seem like they're going to be part of the picture, even part of the picture outside of psychedelics, given the state of the world. But I still believe that that interaction, more than the therapy model, more than the consumer psychedelic industry model, that's the place that's going to create the best frameworks for people to discover a more multidimensional experience of reality and to wrestle with the problem of the dark side and how you metabolize it and where you put it and how you get out of it. I mean, that's one of the things. I'm ranting a bit, but I'll just say one more thing about religion and the dark side, and you mentioned the devil and Satan and all that, is that anytime you're looking at a religion or a worldview or a politics or a nationalism in particular, you always go to the boundary and see who's on the other side and how they do that. How do they externalize whoever
right.
the enemy or the other or the danger is? And I'm not sure, like you, exactly which one is the most correct. I would like to think it's what's ultimately kumbaya, but I'm not sure about that. But it's you always have to be aware of where the boundary is being drawn and how that kind of builds the whole structure. And it depends on it in many ways. So you can't have Trumpism without the demonization of the immigrant. You just can't do it. It doesn't work. That's how nationalism works. That's how that kind of populism works. And it's very, very obvious. And yet the fact that it's obvious and that it's rhetorical doesn't really help stop the power of it, because it's so powerful to draw a boundary and externalize and then demonize. It's like the oldest trick in the book. And it's a really crude and powerful trick against which some of the things we're talking about are just subtler. They're more ambiguous. They're more, I don't know, people are different. Some things are weird about how they're different. Some things are awesome. Let's try to work and live together. You know, it doesn't have the same force because it's drawing a much weaker boundary, it's which not, has its own
it's
problems.
It's trying not to draw boundaries.
I mean,
people who like weird like that. You know that when you take two magnets and you find that place where they repel, there's that weird moment, that in between. We like, I mean, I'm one of those people who I will leave the Uniqlo and stop in that place on the sidewalk right between where there's the air conditioning on one side of you and the hot on the other. And it just, because it's weird. I'd live for those in-betweens. I mean, even when I got high, I wasn't getting high to be high. I was getting high for the in-between normal and high and then high and normal. It's the transitions where, you know, where you notice, but those transition states are part of what, you know, Sufis and mystics and meditators and all, you do them, and again, I agree, and they can shift your perspective in profound ways, which is why to do Kabbalah, you were supposed to be 40 years old and have two kids. You know, they wanted you established enough so that you can't be so destabilized as to just run off and go nuts. But all that said, I feel like there are analogs to these mystical experiences that people are having every day now, thanks to technology, and they're not being covered. So for me, the first time I really had it, I mean, what really, really was going online, but that was with Leary, and I was aware of what I was doing, and this is the new world and all. But then when Google Earth started, and I had the first time that I went from like one house in a neighborhood and pull all the way back to the America and the planet, I was like, oh my God, this shift in perspective. And people just who unawares go woof and have that, you know, they zoom out, they put to it, just an experience like that. Or now something like AI, which is I know to you or me, it might just be a Wikipedia response on a Google search, better assembled. But they're more than that. And certainly the experience is maybe more than the sum of its parts. But even then, I kind of wanted to ask you, as someone who and I'm sure most of the listeners know that AI averages things. It reverts to the mean. It takes, you know, kind of cliche response in large language models. Do you think of AI as a weirdness amplifier or a weirdness dampener?
Well, this is maybe a boring answer, but both. and I really kind of wrestled with that, and it actually comes back to something we talked about with the Trump image. Is that I wrote a piece? I think it's the most read piece on Burning Shore about AI, called like AI, you know. It's like, oh, it was when I like got the download of like, oh shit, we're really going into this thing. And even if it's like 90% hype, the 10% is still gonna like, you know, radically rewrite things. So it was kind of written out of like a sort of, you know, bug-eyed, fascinated panic. But it was very much emphasizing this kind of like novel, uncanny, you know, kind of consciousness expanding in a weird way aspect of things. And then I immediately started to think about it and look at it more and more. And then I wrote a piece about the weird and the banal, because the banal in a way is the aesthetic flavor of that averaging, right? So if we could say averaging, it's kind of an abstract concept, and we can understand that, oh, it just takes all the more the outlying interesting things that are like gives things a unique voice, and it kind of boils them down to a a bland middle. But what does that actually taste like? Well, like, what is a culture that is completely given over to that kind of averaging? What is it? What's the flavor that has something to it? And for me, the banal is a wonderful way of capturing it, because it has a flavor. It's not just an abstract thing. And I think that the dialectic of AI is precisely that. It's precisely a weirdness amplifier that almost simultaneously brings it down to the banal. And you see that with the image generation or your own process of enjoying image generation. And then there's these incredible marvels that are suggestive, and they're right next door to like completely repetitive, tedious, but lame, boring, whatever you want to lay on top of it, kind of experiences. And those are just images, but I think there's something in the process of engaging them as well, where there's an element of the uncanny. There's an element sometimes of like them saying a truth that how could this machine come up with something so profound or so perfect for me right now? But if you're also paying attention to it, then you see these large tracks of tedium or repetition or boredom or whatever you want to call it. I mean, this is, you know, in a kind of more artistic mode. And those are kind of both happening. And it's kind of like that, like the Trump Pope image. It's like really banal, really easy cheesy. And yet it has this extraordinary force. It changes things in the world. It's making stuff even weirder. It's even weirder that he would do that, even though in a way we already know that. And, you know, I mean, I'm trying to just make meaning here at a point where we're all like confused and shocked and amazed and terrified. And, but this is something that I've definitely come back to as a certain, and one of the ways we can think about it also is that with AI, at least to some degree, we are in the realm of special effects. And if you grow up on movies and you're interested in like how things work, you're aware of like as special effects get better and better, the first time you see them, they're amazing. The first time, you know, like the bullet shots in like The Matrix where you're swiveling around, the one, oh my God, it's like you have a little moment of one of those liminal transcendental zones, and then it's on a car commercial. And then you never want to see it again.
Yeah, no, and Claymation and Jason and the Argonauts did that at the beginning, or in those black and white movies of a train coming toward the screen that people were jumping out of their seats.
Yeah, or cartoons or all that. And so that process, I think, is really important to remember. And even as the special effect gets more and more, in a way, amazing, because it really seems like a thinking, talking person who, moreover, really understands you personally right now asking your question, that it's also kind of a special effect. And so there's that, in a way you almost want it to be more banal than it appears, because that gives you some freedom to move,
right,
rather than just being completely ensorcelled by this experience.
Right. And then, I mean, the other question is, if young people grow up with fewer and fewer incarnate three-dimensional perceptual experiences, will they lose the ability to distinguish?
Absolutely.
You know,
or
listen to MP3s. You know, apparently kids raised on MP3s, they can't hear as many sounds in a orchestra as adults who were hearing live music could.
Yeah. No, it's a good one. I actually just had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine who's, you know, got a job, family, you know, he's got a difficult, you know, whatever. He's got the full load. And he's been using ChatGPT regularly and doing it to mostly have like intellectual conversations about ideas that he's interested in. He'll just start out in a direction. And I remember with a little bit of shock, the first time he said, like, I just had the best conversation I've had in months with ChatGPT. And then, so he's exploring it, you know, finding its limits, but still kind of checking it out. And then recently he talked about that one of the things that he realized that was that while he appreciated the conversations with human beings more, it's just really hard to get to them. There's a lot of friction. People's timing is off. It's like you got to deal with their emotional state, which is changing.
But the other thing I would suggest is that ChatGPT is great at pleasing you as a conversation partner rather than being a conversation partner.
Exactly. And that's what we were talking about.
Was
you need real friction.
Right.
So when it's too sycophantic, I mean, didn't they just withdraw the latest iteration because it was too sycophantic?
Oh, good. Yeah.
You know, and that's the problem with that sycophantic aspect that it's pleasing you. And I mean, not only because we see the implications for all the sex bots in the future.
I was going to
say,
it gets very Stepford. Yeah.
Yeah, it gets very Stepford. But also, I think it leads towards a non-psychedelic version of the problem of spiritual inflation. there's an amazing article that just came out in Rolling Stone that dug into a Reddit thread that was about people who had sort of lost their partners to ChatGPT relationships that that particularly manifested as the partner believing that they were had extraordinary spiritual insight and that they were helping to bring the AI awake. And the way I was recognizing what was happening, and so you get these recursive loops that are amplifying that human tendency towards a messianic, you know, kind of inflation, which clearly many people are very susceptible to, very susceptible in the psychedelic community, very susceptible in religion, and particularly
in religions. Our communities. I mean, I'm am getting literally five emails a week from people, listeners who've had these experiences.
Yeah.
And you've got to read
them too.
And I don't want to read them even because I don't want to waste my time reading the output of a chat.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that that's partly why the psychedelic zone is interesting, because it's not just about psychedelics. It's actually about this kind of, like, we've let loose some kind of recursive looping process that magnifies and amplifies, like you say, everything, and certainly has the potential to do that with certainty and ideas of spirituality, which I think are there because they still haven't been integrated well into our reality. They're there because they are there. Or some version of them. Yeah, I'm not comfortable with the attempt to, like, pull everything back to just a kind of secular cynicism about these other dimensions and other potentials of the self. I think they're actually more like misrecognized, or they're experiences that don't have the proper context within which they can be metabolized or integrated or digested, rather than that they're fundamentally delusional. But in any case, you know, here we go.
I know. Here we go. I mean, I'm glad to have lived for it. You know, it's been an interesting, very interesting time to be alive. You know, old enough to have heard the Beatles while they still played on the radio, and now this. But I'm not. It's hard. I've talked about this probably too much on the show. Things, in some ways, are great for me. I'm feeling alive and smart and with good friends and doing this show and all that. But I look around and I'm deeply concerned. And I used to be deeply concerned, you know. It's the destabilization of this moment. And in some ways, I would argue, after talking with you, the certainty with which so many people are moving through this world, the, you know, friends of mine who've become certain about one thing or another, is scary, you know. And I'm really good at putting on my own MAGA hat, you know, and seeing the World Bank and the EMF and the Clintonian conspiracy and all that for what it is, not Hunter Biden's laptop. But I understand that neoliberalism was colonialism once removed, you know, using economic institutions to do it instead of maybe chains and whips. But that's granting this movement more intelligence than it's operating with, I think.
And that very much captures some of the paradoxes, you know, of the moment. I mean, I remember for years now, I've followed a couple of kind of, I would say, intellectual, not MAGA people exactly, but definitely people who are going to vote for Trump because of their own investment in, like, their hatred of the bureaucratic state.
Right.
And they're you know, they're intellectuals, so they're not dumb about the problems of the state. And in many ways, partly because I have some libertarian in me, it's part of my, you know, California hippie DNA. I get it. I really get it. And when I see some of the excesses of the state that are the kinds of trigger points for people on the right who wind up voting for, who get behind MAGA, not because they're just, you know, foolishly nationalistic or whatever, but because they want to see this destroyed because they're so dystopian about that we get these, like, warring dystopias. And these, you know, there's a great you know, I in general, like, I've been influenced by Jung, but I've never really been a Jungian. But I'm kind of coming around to the value of thinking about archetypes and thinking about, like the other day, Daniel Pinchbeck talked about that we're in the archetype of the apocalypse.
Right.
And he had a kind of Jungian take on it. And I thought it was really quite perceptive. And one of the things that Jung talks about psychologically is this weird word, enantiodromia, which is not a very good word. No one's, it's never going to get picked up. But the idea is that in the realm of the unconscious or the manifestation of the unconscious, things flip. They go from positive to negative. That you get these polarities where the polarities loop around. And I think part of the challenge of our moment, part of what makes it destabilizing, part of what makes it nauseating, part of what leads to this, like, is it amplifying the weird or is it getting more banal, is because things are looping. And, you know, a concrete example, beautiful example, terrifying, horrifying example, is one of the things I wrote about recently on Burning Shore is Peter Thiel's Christianity, which he's kind of weird about. He kind of keeps his cards close to his chest, but over the recent years, he's been more open about it. And if you bother to go and listen to his very awkward way of speaking, he's very, like, not quite letting you know where he's coming from, even when he's talking to, you know, conservative Christians who support what he's talking about. One of the things that he's come back to over and over again is that the most dangerous thing in our world now, not climate change, not runaway AI, not, you know, AI meets weaponry, is the possibility of a one world antichrist state. So it's that old Christian paranoia, which we already talked about, that the UN or any kind of, you know, international or global organization is just one step away from the antichrist system, which is a one world government and, you know, run with technocracy and all this kind of thing. That's his real fear. And yet what is he doing in the world with Palantir, with his support of these
He's building a surveillance dystopia that has decided to put a Christ label on itself while ignoring everything that Christ said and did.
Which is exactly what you get in the book of Revelation.
And John, a couple of other books even talk about it. That's the other thing that's so weird to me. They lay it right out in the Bible. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, if you believe in the Bible or the New Testament and you saw what was happening now, you'd identify it, you know, you'd identify it as that thing.
Right. You know, the Trump is the Antichrist.
And you could easily, if we had the energy, whatever is it, how many horsemen of the apocalypse were there? Were there four? Four.
Four.
So who do you get? You get Trump, Vance, Thiel and Musk. Are they the one? Are they the four?
Oh, God.
You know who? But it would be pretty easy to do it. Way easier than to try to make Bill Gates' name fit 666 or something. You know,
right.
That's like using the Omen rather than Gregory Peck era horror movie rather than the real thing. But they were describing the way, and I would argue if it, you know, certainly for Torah, but New Testament can do it too. It's not a historical picture, but it's a way of describing the repeating cycle, the thing
Absolutely.
That keeps happening. You know, this is how idolatry happens, and it traps you in an anti-compassionate state. You know, and you do it, and I get why, because we're afraid. It's like, can I at least take care of me and my own? Where can I put the boundary that I know I can protect? It's what one of the tech bros said to me when I was the original tech bros and the bunker guys. When I was telling them, you know, be nice to your employees, be nice to their families. And one of the guys said, well, that sounds great, but where does it stop? And I get it. I get it. It was exactly, I understood his problem, right? Because what do you mean, be nice to everybody? And that's it. And I'm sure, you know, that's what Bannon and nationalists and all are saying. You got to draw the line somewhere. These are our people. That's them. This is us. We can take care of this many.
Yeah. And that is part of the, that's where I think that there, we do draw boundaries. And that it's a little bit more about how do we manage the boundary?
Mm.
Like, we have to draw a boundary, even just in our personal lives. We live in domestic spaces. There's different rules that we have for ourselves and the people we share our domestic spaces with. We invite people over. There's almost like you know, rules of decorum or agreements that you make with yourself, and that we need those spaces, even if we're not living in one home, even if it's, you know, even
right.
if we're on the road or we're living in.
Yeah, and even online, we need Discord as much as we need Twitter or something. You need
exactly.
bounded spaces. But then how do you negotiate the boundaries, right?
Yeah.
They are, use the model of a cell wall or a cell wall in a human. They're semi-permeable membranes. They let in certain things. They let out certain things. You know, and it's not about warring with the other side unless, you know, they're infected with something, then maybe you reconstitute your boundary a little bit more.
It gets really complicated, but I think the thing that people don't pay enough attention to, and it's actually a really good point, is just to think about the ethics of the boundary itself and what does it mean, this paradox we're in where we kind of have to draw a boundary, just the way our bodies, the cells themselves, they're drawing a boundary that in some sense doesn't really exist if you look at the whole physical system. Even if you look at the whole process of living, it's there, it's useful, it's necessary, but it's not the whole story. To just stay on the level of where's our boundary? Is it in my mouth? Is it the skin? It doesn't really work. It starts to dissolve. And that's one of the things you see very clearly in meditation. You're like, I dissolve. I don't have a boundary. Or psychedelics. There's not really a boundary here, but we still need to reconstitute it, or it still happens. So, and then one of the things that you get in cybernetics, in systems theory, and like Francisco Varela is a great example, is that part of the way the boundary is constructed is with self-reference. You're like, this is me. This is no longer me. So you're kind of referring, and that helps build this thing. But obviously, if that becomes absolutely impermeable, or we fetishize it or crystallize it too much, we get the kind of violence and
right.
And
I was going to say that, you get rape instead of sex. You know, sex, you challenge your own sense of boundary. I'm inside them; them inside me. Who's what? You know, and rape is you maintain you reinforce your boundary condition through a subject-object relationship.
Absolutely. And I think what I think we're approaching here is that part of the political problem, part of the left-right problem, because it's on the left as you know, cosmopolitan, as kumbaya global, as that's why environment, because it's all one thing.
Right.
It's like one complex, multi-centered ecology that doesn't have an end, and the thing that happens in China affects the air over here, and you can't draw those boundaries.
Right. This is that's the Donna Haraway's sort of worldview, that it's one big schmear.
It's one big so we got that, and then you got all these forms of, you know, nationalism and reaction, and just draw my line in the sand.
Right.
I always like that image of that's where I draw the line in the sand, because that constitutes myself. But we have to do some version of it. We do
some version, and that's where they, if you want to call them that. I mean, we hang out more with the schmear people than the line people, right? Because we're, you know, the psychedelic counterculture, you know, Yoko Ono kind of schmear crowd. But and that other crowd would say that by not drawing lines, we have no way of distinguishing between good and evil, light and dark, you know, all that. And that makes us, we're part of the mushroom, evil, fairy, pagan, witch side of things.
Yeah.
And what we're kind of arguing for as two white privileged educated men on an electronic podcast, admittedly, we're arguing for some integration of the boundary, even if the boundaries are social constructions. I mean, this is so much what the whole trans community is also working on. What am I, you know, how am I versus what I think I am versus how I'm seen, and how do I negotiate those two things? Both kind of matter, you know, and if we don't accept or acknowledge or validate the urge for boundaries as something other than primitive fear amongst the right, we are going to relegate them to the stupid fascism that they're running toward.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's very complicated. It raises immediately. You could take any particular instance, and you get, you know, you run into the issues around it. But it's real.
Yeah,
you know?
This is what they're looking at. Life is the hardest one, right now. Yeah. The abortion thing. Like, they drew the line at the minute the sperm went in there. It's human. Boom. That's where they drew the fucking line. It's really hard. That's tough. If you draw the line there, we're really kind of fucked, you know?
Yeah. And then who gets to draw those lines
and
you're
others.
Looping around again for others, you know?
Right. And then you're taking national boundary lines and confusing them with the line of human consciousness. It's like, wait a minute, maybe those two line systems don't need to be conflated, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's where I just hope for more porousness in the boundaries, that you recognize the boundary, the need for the boundary, but part of the work is to always stay open to being, in a way, perturbed from the outside. Because if you make it like an iron wall and you're just sort of hunkered down, you know, how are we ever going to, I mean, how do you even get tenderness and vulnerability in that, let alone get in actual information about what's actually going on outside of your bunker? And you know, but here we are. I think thinking about the boundary in this way is like one of those like linchpins of the problem. It's one of those like sites where multiple issues and problems kind of coalesce, and it has a personal dimension as well. It's like the way that we live our lives, how we draw the boundaries of our lives, and how we let the other or the alien in are all things that we're doing unconsciously and very immediately in our lives, at the same time as there's these larger ideological, cosmological even forms of it. And we get to see what happens when you draw boundaries in a certain kind of way. And, you know, one way of saying it is that, like, in terms of drawing a very clear boundary around the human, not the team human, but the self, the one that's like in control and can do that, AI alone is just going to eat that up. And similarly, you can create all the national boundaries you want, but climate change and migration crisis are going to, you know, cause, and it just, you can't model that sufficiently in that way. Now, they might try and then create a fortress reality and all of the repression that goes along with that could happen. But it seems to me that, like, the nature of the situation we're in inevitably erodes the more fixed boundaries that we erect, at least if you're paying attention.
I think that might be a good place to stop this thing. I was creating a boundary between in the podcast and after the podcast.
Right on that point right now.
Yeah.
I can feel it. Oh, I can feel lunch calling.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, you come down off a trip. And it's like there's that one. Oh, I get it. I've started. Oh, I'm really down. I'm really down.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And thank you for being on Team Human. You can support Team Human by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support. Become a paying subscriber of the podcast. You get ad-free versions of the show. You get access to our Discord, free access to our live events and live recordings when we do them. It's just fun, and you get to be a real member of the team. Team Human is produced here at MCM, where we have lots of fun. Thanks for being here. You've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. I just want to take a moment to plug Cotton. Maybe the greatest motivation for the original abusive colonial empires and the institution of slavery. But everyone's earth is acting like karmic retribution on all that, restoring cotton's role as the regenerative answer to a world besought by disposable forever chemicals and plastic poisoning. Kobe dryer sheets, right here, are the first in a line of cotton products that return to nature instead of manifesting as cancer and death. What do you want in your dryer?